Good afternoon. This is Gary Kavanagh here on TRSI. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer, for a special royalist edition of TRSI, here to celebrate the coronation. Michael, how have you been? And how do you feel about our monarch's incoming reign?
The royalist bit slightly threw me for a second. And then yes, of course, it's a coronation and yeah, blah, blah, blah. So, well, we're tremendously excited because we're now going to look at a young, ambitious, morally vacuous, conservative, was progressive, is Fine Gaeler, who is south of the Liffey rather than someone who is north of the Liffey. So that's going to make just a huge difference, I think, to the way the country is governed and everything about the philosophy of this government, you know. I mean, he's so far south of the Liffey, he's in Wicklow. I mean, I can't imagine how more substantial and important kind of shift that represents in Irish politics. Now, in no other way is there any change, but, you know, you can't ask for more than that, it seems to me, if you're going to be reasonable.
So, obviously, Simon Harris is going to be the Fine Gael leader. He is so obviously going to be the Fine Gael leader that Fine Gael actually reduced the amount of time available for other people to say that they wanted to be the leader because it was so obviously going to be Simon Harris. A blitzkrieg of a campaign, we might say.
Kind of a blitzkrieg, kind of not. You know the old saying about going bankrupt? The guy asked, so you went bankrupt. How did it happen? He said, well, very slowly at first and then all of a sudden. I suppose we should first of all talk about Leo. And the first thing I wanted to observe about that is he had obviously told nobody, genuinely nobody. And that may even include the people in his private life. I don't know. Because, Gary, I got the phone call maybe 10 o'clock that morning. Immediately, I got onto my little friends and this inside in blue shirtdom, and they said, no, total surprise, out of the blue. Nobody knew it was coming. He arrived in, went to the cabinet, told the cabinet, went and made the announcement. Now, you and I know, Gary, this government, let alone this Fine Gael party, the only way two people can keep a secret is if one of them is dead. So this genuinely, I mean, I was trying to write a thing there and say, you know, we live in an age where politicians can exacerbate us, annoy us, outrage us, disgust us, bore us, occasionally maybe even amuse us, but they almost never surprise us. And hey, Leo surprised us.
I think word of it started that something was happening leaked the morning of it, and then a lot of people's phones just started turning off one after the other.
Yeah. True.
But it was only very shortly before the actual announcement that anyone had managed to confirm that, yeah, this looks like Leo is going. And then Leo comes out, and probably the most emotional I've ever seen Leo. He cried.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I'm the only person that... Not that it was similar, but in some way it reminded me of when Mrs. Thatcher was leaving Downing Street for the last time and became emotional and was moved to the point of tears. And I thought, there you go. This must be... Because, of course, once upon a time, you know, Leo was a big fan of the Mrs. Thatcher. Once upon a time in the long, long ago. But yes, it was towards the end. You're talking about the bit towards the end of the speech, or the announcement, or whatever. He appeared to be genuinely in the grip of emotion. And I don't think that Leo is one of those people that can do that.
No, I don't think so either. If anything, Leo's issue is that he has this incredibly flat effect.
Yeah.
When you're talking to him, there's no emotional kind of recognition of anything. So to see him crying was actually quite unexpected. Mm. And then, of course, it became the question of, well, why has Leo resigned? There were two parts of that. One was, why has he resigned in general? And second was, why has he resigned right now? A certain amount of the media are currently now desperately trying to figure out, was there some scandal? Was there something over him? Was there, you know, something that changed? I don't know. I think probably even bets that there was an issue internally, or basically he just got tired of the entire thing and decided, I'm done. This is it.
I was told by not somebody who is a politician, but shall we say someone who works in politics and has been deep in politics for decades now and knows indeed where some of the bodies are buried and where the bogs are. And he said that in the manner of someone who was telling me something that everybody has known this at least for the last month, that Simon had been involved not in what you'd call a heave, but kind of a proto-heave, a pre-heave for the last 2 or 3 months. Now, basically, I think he was going around the party stirring up apathy, you know, but that he had been actively out there. And now, we know that Leo has never been popular with the rank and file. You can see that from the vote he got, or the vote he didn't get when he ran against Coveney. The discussion is that dissatisfaction in the rank and file had now spread to the parliamentary party. If you look at where the party was in 2011, Gary, right, where it's only a few seats off getting an overall majority, and we fast forward to 2024, 13 years later, having been the great hope, they're down to 34 seats. Like, their representation in the Dáil has halved, more than. They're not really on the trajectory that people would have hoped. There's a hell of a lot of people in the Dáil who think they're going to lose their jobs. So one theory is that a friend or somebody in the middle went and said, Leo, right now Harris has 20 names, 22, whatever. He's going to be in a position very soon to take you out. Maybe the best thing is to do is to go before you're pushed. Okay, in the context of this, and this is all obviously pure speculation, but Gary, did Leo give you the impression for the last year or so that he was a man engaged by what he was doing?
No, but he hasn't given me that impression for a relatively long while. I did note, however, when I was talking to people, that more and more people who are not me were starting to say things like, he's just very tired, like his heart is clearly not in it, which I thought had been true for a considerable time. I think you, on the numbers and on Harris has not been doing that for the last few months. Harris has been doing that since he got into the Department of Higher Education. And before that, he was still doing that.
Oh, yeah, listen, I would say Harris has been doing that since. There was a time when, before he was in the Dáil, Harris was running for both the town council, I think it was the town council in Bray and Wicklow County Council. And a big wig in Fine Gael said to a mutual friend of ours, you know, I think he's making a mistake there. He should really just concentrate on one or the other. He can't do both. And our friend said, oh, no. You are deeply mistaken. He can do both, and he's getting ready for the next step. That man is going to be... I don't know if he said that on that occasion or the later. Fairly soon afterwards, he actually did say that man is going to be the leader of Fine Gael one day. Harris has been getting ready for this for a long time.
Yeah, and moving into the Department of Higher Education gave him a lot of scope to do a lot of this. Sometimes one of those, you know, like the department where you're handling sports affairs, gives you a lot of excuse to travel around the country talking to people, giving good news.
And you don't really have much of a job. You've plenty of time. You're not making policy decisions or anything. You're not going to do anything which is deeply unpopular. So yeah, it's a good position. It's a handing out money and grants kind of a job.
On the numbers, I mean, our estimates, what, a year or two ago were that about 10 to, I think, 12 Fine Gaelers were not going to run in the next election.
Yes.
It looks like that's now going to be 14 or so Fine Gaelers not running in the next election. And at that point, that is, what, over 40% of their TDs expected to say that they will not run. That voting mass on its own, because you've got to assume if you're not going to run, a lot of that is directed at Leo and at his performance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a fairly ready-made block of people willing to go against you in any attempt at heave.
You saw, I don't know, you saw Josefa has announced?
Josefa announced her resignation in the same tone as someone might tell you they haven't been hurt by their captors. But yeah. You can clearly tell there's a gun to the back of their head. Like, the first line of their resignation is that they support Simon Harris becoming leader of Fine Gael.
Leo has not confirmed or denied, I think, whether or not he's going to stand. You know that Simon has announced this thing where anybody who wants to continue to be a cabinet minister has to commit to running in the next Dáil election. What do you think of that? As a strategy, shall we say? Or a tactic?
I think it rather depends on who's in the cabinet and what you know about them. I mean, it seems to make sense. If you're not going to run again, I would make this point actually to start with. I think the cabinet system we use is nonsense and that we should switch to a presidential style cabinet where you elect the Taoiseach and then the Taoiseach just picks who's in the cabinet and they don't have to be politicians. But if they're going to be politicians, I suppose that, you know, a big part of being a minister is an increased profile, an increased ability to send things to your constituency. And if you're not going to run again, particularly at this point, then, yeah, it probably makes sense that you're not there. It's going to be hell for the, you know, this whole gender-balanced cabinet, Michael.
I understand why you might want to do that. But I'm more interested in what you think this is a way to do it. Because, okay, you want to... First of all, you can announce it, but there's absolutely no way you can enforce it. Because if it comes to it, people say, okay, I'll run again. And then election, and they go, actually, I'm not going to run. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to sue them for breach of contract? But more importantly, right, I think it's a kind of a bully move.
Well, yeah.
So take Pascal O'Donoghue, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that Simon Harris can bully Pascal. And I think that, if anything, Pascal's reaction is more likely to be, well, fuck you. Because what happens if Pascal turns around and says, instead of, okay, I'm going to commit, he says, okay, I'm going. Who's Simon going to appoint as Minister for Finance? Who is he going to replace that is going to be better than Pascal and do this media job that Pascal can do and be the reassuring figure of competence that Pascal is? All he's going to do is leave himself to try and fill a job, and a job that he really will struggle to fill.
So there is an assumption there behind what you're saying, Michael, which is this, that Simon Harris intends the government to last long enough for him to be required to fill any of those positions.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure is all that certain. I think if you're Harris, okay, you get the Fine Gael leadership. You will become Taoiseach with almost certainty, unless the other parties decide to pull the rug under from you. And considering that the latest Red Sea poll, which we will talk about, shows independents polling higher than Fianna Fáil, that's probably not going to happen. But you have, at best, a year to turn this ship around.
No, you don't have a year. The latest you can have a general election is sort of the 10th of March, right? Which means you're going to have to be calling the election sometime in the second week in February. So I'm being picky here, but yeah, it's almost. But you don't even have a year to do that, and that's calling an election in February, Gary. And you can ascribe to the wisdom or not. The reality, it is historically believed you never call an election in February because that's the month when people get their bills from Christmas. And people are not going to feel warm and fuzzy towards the government. So the reality is that we're probably looking before Christmas at this stage.
That gives Simon, regardless of the guts of a year, gives Simon very little time to actually try and right the ship to the extent he can or to try and make his mark on it. So what if he just goes earlier? What if he goes, let's say, on the same day as the Europeans and the locals?
Okay. I was asking a couple of people who are old hands at this. I'm not, and I don't mean legally. I mean, politically and practically, mm-hmm. is it possible to run a general election on the same day as the general, as the locals and the Europeans?
I think yes. I think there are many advantages that the large parties can take can use. For one of them, Michael, all of the large parties are members of European parties. European parties have, this might be an interesting thing for people. In Ireland, there is a general sort of prohibition on foreign funds. They're very tightly controlled, foreign funds coming in to fund elections. European political parties are exempt from that. So European political parties actually put in substantial amounts of money into their, not just in Ireland, elections all over Europe, EU money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have that and you're putting on events to, you know, let's say elect someone to the European Parliament, very easy to fold, you know, a town hall where it was just going to be the European Parliament to also be, you know, your TD for the area. So there will be an amount of money that they will be able to use basically for cross purposes that the smaller parties won't. The independents are polling massively. They, the things they lack tend to be organisational ability and money.
Yes.
So they will be massively put out by this. It might be a way to force those down. And also, Simon can do a sort of very nice, no, of course, we're not going to do it, and then pull the rug out at the very last minute. And you might say that's a terrible situation for a political party to be in, but I would counter with this point. Fine Gael are likely going to enter this general election with over 40% of their sitting TDs not running. The strongest indication that someone is going to get elected is that they have been elected before. So Fine Gael are already, you know, in all likelihoods, going to be just torn apart in the next general election. So if they're already in a terrible position, well, a little bit of additional chaos actually doesn't hurt them as much as it could if they were, you know, going from full strength.
Okay, here's a, but as a counterpoint to that, right? Normally, I would say the conventions for Dáil elections, general elections, would be held around a year out, at least, from the election, right?
Mm-hmm.
To my knowledge, there are a number of constituencies out there, a lot of, who have not yet had their conventions. So the candidates haven't been decided. Now, because so many places are not running incumbents, the conventional wisdom would be that the longer you can give your new nominees to get around the constituency and to get known outside of their local area, to establish a kind of a profile, the better it will be for them. Because the chances are Fine Gael are going to be running people that then Fianna Fáil are much less affected by the retirement syndrome because they were hit by this in 2011. So Fianna Fáil are going to be running established candidates. The Shinners are going to be running established candidates. The rest of them, more or less. But it may be the case that Fine Gael, more than other parties, is in a position where they're running new faces, fresh faces, that need time to get well known. A snap election for them could be an absolute disaster because you're going to have names on the ballot sheet that nobody recognises outside of their parish.
I mean, entirely possible. But then again, it's entirely possible that if you push this back as far as you can, the independents and Sinn Féin use the local elections to become much more powerful than they are.
Yeah.
And then you basically have a year where they embed their people and their own people become much more useful for a general election, and you go in against much more organised and systematic opposition.
Also, I would say, to your point, I would say that if you're Fine Gael, you might say, you know what, Sinn Féin have been trending down and are continuing to trend down for a little bit of time now, quite a bit of time now. You can take a bet. If you're a gambling person, you can say, you know what, I think that they're a busted flush. They're going to keep going down. They're going to go down to 22. They're going to go down to 20. They're going to go down to 18. We don't have to worry. However, if I was that gambling man, my sense would be, you know what? I think there's a floor to how far they can go. And that floor is going to be hit in the next couple of months. Maybe they're going to trend down for another little bit. But I wouldn't give, I would say better hit them when they're trending down rather than wait until they have a chance to recover. And I think there's a decent chance that they may, that they'll find a way, they'll find a message, they'll find a strategy, that, and they will start to trend up again. Better hit them now when they're going down rather than wait for the, give them an opportunity to get themselves reorganized and to recover. So if that was the case, well, then now rather than later would be the time to go. Now, the other thing that what people were saying about the, why you wouldn't hold it in June is because the county councillors, we're having a group chat about this, and it was observed, and I think correctly, that county councillors would go absolutely fucking apeshit if a general was held on the same day. The counter to that was, and do you think that Fine Gael HQ gives a flying fuck what county councillors think? No, I think they should do. And I think they should care about them a lot more than they do, but I don't think that they do. So I don't think that will come into it.
No, I think the question is not, you know, will it piss off people? It'll obviously piss off people. It's how, if they want to do this, how they can present it, what reason they can come up for it to be there, which may actually be quite helped by all of the opposition parties demanding that the Taoiseach should be chosen by general election, which is an interesting new legal view.
Yeah.
Of how we should elect our Taoiseach, that you would have thought some of these people would have been aware of. I think there's where they go for this, there's absolutely no doubt it would cause absolute chaos. Like, it would be insane. But it could be quite useful for Simon Harris. I suppose that's the old, is it good for the country? No. Is it good for Simon Harris? Maybe.
I wanted to say this before I forget. You remember during the referendum campaign, and I'm sure I know you do remember, but the listeners may remember, Neil Richmond famously came out and said that one of the great things about this amendment was that it was going to open up new interesting vistas and possibilities for family reunification for people who had applied for asylum in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, at the time, yourself and myself and others around the country were a little bit puzzled about why Neil thought this was a good thing to say, why this was something that would energize the public to go out and vote for the amendment. Anyway, how about this for a minor conspiracy theory, Gary, right? There has been a lot of buzz in the press about the fact that certain older members of the cabinet are going to be invited to make way for new, fresh, exciting young faces. Because Fine Gael is full of fresh and exciting young faces to come into cabinet. So, for example, Simon Coveney. Maybe it's time for Simon to go back and farm his beef cattle and milk his cows. And make way for the likes of Neil Richmond. So, there's all this talk. There has been talk that Neil has been part of the cabal. Now, one of the other reasons that has been given for being part, and I would say there are a number of parts to Leo's timing, is, and this I have heard independently of other stuff from a couple of TDs and Shanador, that there was a feeling within the parliamentary party that Leo had unnecessarily nailed the party to the amendments, that they could have taken a kind of a semi-detached approach to it. They could have done a bit of work at the beginning and then kind of eased off, but that for whatever reason, Leo not only stuck them to it, but he doubled down, and that there was a sense that Leo was personally responsible for the attachment of Fine Gael to such a thumping loss in the ballot box.
Well, I mean, I've got to agree with such a view, Michael, because I think we were possibly the only people I heard saying it.
Well, that was our view, certainly. Now, how? Okay, and here's the kick. At the time, we jokingly suggested that maybe this was a manifestation that Neil actually wanted the referendum to lose, because maybe he was intellectually or spiritually opposed to the referendum. But he didn't want to say that because he's a loyal Fine Gael man. So he actually, what he did was he said this in order to damage the referendum while looking like he supported it. But what if this, Gary, what if this is all part of a brilliant Simon-led plan to undermine the referendum in such an extent that it would deliver a stinging loss that Leo would be infected by undermining Leo and leading to the coronation and accession of King Simon.
Well, I think, you know, Michael, to do something like that would require, should we say, a certain level of willingness to play hard and rough with democratic norms.
Yeah, okay. I have no problem with believing that would be okay.
But given that Simon Harris is less of a man and more of a shadow of a man made entirely of his own ambition.
Yeah.
I actually wouldn't really doubt that he'd be capable of doing something like that. Where I would doubt is Neil Richmond's, you know, involvement in it. But Harris on his own coming up with such an idea, absolutely have no problem believing that. I think that's why Harris could actually be a good Taoiseach. He could also be absolutely atrocious. Because I don't think Harris is going to be stopped by a lot of those things like, you know, those niceties, Michael. Those constitutional niceties. I think if Harris thinks that he needs to do something to remain in power, he'll do it. Regardless of what it is.
Yeah, I think what we have to hope is that in some sense the ideological or the philosophical winds shift in such a way that Harris will put his finger up in the air, decide that's where the wind is blowing and that's the way he's going to go. And that, as it turns out, the winds have turned in the direction that we would like to see them turn. I don't think that Harris is going to be married to any particular philosophical or conviction. He will not, which means, yes, he could be very good. He could be the ultimate perfect pragmatist. The thing that would worry me is, what would you rate thus far, not his political skills, not his capacity to play political games within the party, within the system, but his capacity to manage? Like, if you look at his, what he did in the Department of Health, for example.
Oh, he's been a terrible manager. Harris has always been able to get headlines, he's always been able to build relationships. He's always been able to be maintain relatively friendly people, relationships with people who actually don't like him at all, oftentimes. Yeah. He's too Fianna Fáil. He's too obviously untrustworthy. Incredibly untrustworthy. And he's never been able to actually deliver anything. But then again, Michael, I think the point I'd make here is that I don't think he's ever had to deliver anything. The political advantage in whatever position he's found himself in has never been to actually deliver things. Like, he was the health minister. No one expects you to deliver anything. Your job is to get out of it.
Angola, yeah. You know what? Maybe the best job for him is Taoiseach. Because he effectively won't have a department that he has to manage. He'll have to establish a general direction of policy, and he'll have to manage the relationships with the government. Now, for example, I could imagine if you were a bigwig in a number of Irish NGOs, you could be very happy this morning because you could be thinking, you know what? We have a great relationship with Simon. We worked together on repeal. We had lovely lunches. He's such a good guy. And this is going to be fantastic. Now, to those NGOs, in the unlikely circumstance that they're actually listening to this, I would say, I would wait. I would wait and see. Because I don't think that Simon is a man that can be relied upon in times of stormy seas. I think if Simon decides that it's going to be in Simon's interest to drop you like a wet, like a hot snot, then I think you will be dropped. I think this, I put it this way. If I was out in public and Simon came off and kissed me on the cheek, I would be more worried that I was going to be taken off for crucifixion than this was a sign of deep affection from Simon.
I did like the Independent ran, running a lot of pieces on Simon, obviously, and expectedly. But there was one of them where they were giving people's views on him. And one of the views was that he was an absolute narcissist and that would be a great help to him now because he would have to deliver. And then it noted that this was someone who was a Harris supporter.
Yes, a supporter called him a narcissist.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that is where we are at. It's the support for Harris is utilitarian, I would say. No one, this is not going to be a moral Taoiseach.
You know the story well because you've heard it a number of times. A mutual friend of ours who introduced me to Harris many, many, many years ago. And he introduced me without comment or preparation, and he left him. And he went off to get some sandwiches and tea and came back and said to me, "So what did you think?" And he quotes this, Jesus, we're talking 15 years ago now this was. And he still quotes it. He said, "You looked at me and you said, the force is strong with this one, but I feel the power of the dark side." And I hadn't realised, but he had in fact come from Ogre Fianna Fáil, which was, Fianna Fáil was what we used to refer to as the dark side, because I used to say to them, he was a blue shirt, "You know, come over to the dark side, you do not know the power of the force." He has something about him, Gary. You can't, anybody who meets him, there is something about him. It is, sometimes there's a sense of a hollow man. There is a sense of driving ambition. But the word there is driving. You know? And in an age where many of our politicians seem to be aimless and drifting, they're like little boats on a pond that you push one way and you push another. Simon at least gives the impression that he has his own engine. And Simon is going to go whichever way Simon wants to go.
Simon has a very clear North Star, as they say in business. It's just a bit disconcerting because that North Star is clearly him.
Yeah, I don't know if I would actually have said narcissist, though. I mean, I would say lots of bad things about Simon. I'm very happy to say bad things. I'm not sure if narcissist is actually, though, is right.
I think, I mean, I've said some very negative things about Simon Harris that I think were well earned. The problem here, I think, in analysing what Harris is likely to be as Taoiseach, is that people are basing their views on what Harris has been like to this point.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that I don't think that's actually a prediction of what Harris is going to do now. I think Harris, the incentives for Harris have changed now. There were certain things he did before because they were in his political interest. But when you're Taoiseach, certain other things are in your interest. Delivery becomes much more important.
Yes.
And I don't think Harris is tied to any of his positions in the past. Like you, I would be, if I was with the NGOs, I would be, I'd be watching to see where that went. And knowing that at any time, even if it seems to be going well, he may decide, actually, I'm done with this and you're just going to be left in the dustbin. So I don't know. I think Harris has a set of particular personality flaws which could see him actually become quite a good Taoiseach. Or I could see him being absolutely disastrous. And I think that's not going to depend on any political ideology he has. I think it's going to depend nearly entirely on who he decides to listen to and what he personally thinks he should do. And I think that's about it. So it's very difficult to say Harris did well or Harris did badly or Harris is good or Harris is bad and therefore this will happen, because I don't think that matters.
No. I mean, in many regards, himself and Leo are incredibly similar, but not their personalities. Very different personalities. There are similarities. I mean, when Leo came into the party, into the Dáil, and also, actually, they're more similarities. Harris gets a huge vote at the local election. Simon, Leo does badly. He gets co-opted when Sheila Terry gets, I think this is it, Sheila Terry got elected to the Senate after a conversation with her husband. I am told this is, they selected Leo to replace him because they didn't think Leo was going to be a problem. Leo would be okay. Leo went on and got something like 5,000 first preferences in the county council elections. I think it's still a record at a national level of a council vote. He just immediately establishes himself as the candidate for Castleknock for next time out. He gets elected. Now, I don't know if you wouldn't remember because your age, but you've read. When Leo comes in, Leo is a Thatcherite, and he's one of the few people in Ireland who didn't have a problem with that epithet being applied to him. He was bone dry on economics. He was going to make a bonfire of the vanity of the NGOs. He was hardline pro-life. He was pro-traditional family. He had believed in the rights of children to have a mother and a father and all of that. Simon Harris was the same. I remember Simon. Simon was very, very strongly pro-life. For him, it was a red line issue. Simon was unwilling to consider coalition with Labour because, you know, Labour might pressure Fine Gael on the life issue. Both of them went on a journey. They both evolved. And we can look back and now wonder, well, when did they used to believe that and they now believe this? Or did they never really believe that, but now they do believe this? Or actually, they still believe that, but that didn't work, so they had to go along with this. I just find it hard. How much would you believe that an adult man at the age of 30 could, in the space of maybe 4 or 5 years, fundamentally and radically change his views on foundational moral or philosophical issues?
Well, I don't put a lot of stock in, reason. So I actually don't find it terribly difficult to believe someone could change even quite fundamental political understandings if their situation changes. Now, Harris was able to swing it as, my wife got pregnant and therefore I changed my mind on this. So I can actually believe that. Also, it's Harris, so there's not a lot of uprooting of political belief to change what you believe. But that is to Harris's advantage. He can at least swing things so it sounds like, oh, yeah, maybe that did happen.
Did you ever see a film called Torch Song Trilogy?
I have not.
It's a very funny, very good film based on a play written by Harvey Firestein, who is that very funny American character actor with the incredible voice. Anyway, in it he plays a drag queen. And at the beginning of it, he's talking about the affairs he's had with various men. And he talks about this one guy who he was in love with. And the guy was deaf, so you can't see me obviously doing this to your listener, but in this, he's showing the fact that in this affair with this man, he learned some sign language. And he does this very affecting sign because it repeats during the thing. And I kept on thinking this when Leo left and Simon came on and people talked about their change and the evolution. Because at once the character says to the camera, "Did I love him? Yes, I did. But not enough." And my suspicion, and Gary, that's all it can be, because I have no window into their souls, is that Simon and Leo did believe this stuff when they were 30. They believed it, but not enough. So that when it became necessary to move or to evolve or to change or to go on a journey, they went on that journey. You know what? There may be still part of them which still believes what they used to believe. Just not enough.
Well, the thing there, Michael, is it's advantageous to actually believe what you're saying.
It is. It helps.
So, I mean, if I were to sum up kind of Harris and where I think he will go on things in any general direction, it would probably be with the line, "I love you, but I love me more."
Yeah, okay. I'm more imagining it something like, "It's not that I don't love you, but right now, I think it's more important to love me more."
One interesting thing to note here. We were talking about why Leo decided to quote now, particularly. One interesting tidbit that has come up, but it's come up primarily by people who have a very friendly relationship with him, is Phil Hogan. And some sort of undercurrent that Phil Hogan had something to do with this. Now, it's only being put out by people who I said, Michael, have quite a good relationship with Phil Hogan so far in the media. So I would question there if Phil Hogan had any involvement or if Phil Hogan is trying to insert himself back into Irish politics. It's being said that Hogan is advising Harris. Now, there's a very big difference between someone saying they're advising someone and the person they say they're advising actually giving a shit what that person is saying.
Well, we know of two very important political journalists in Ireland who have a very good relationship with Phil Hogan. So it's possible that this story is coming via that. I am very sceptical about the degree to which Phil Hogan has any influence in Irish / Fine Gael politics today. Would I be disappointed or concerned if Simon Harris was taking advice from Phil? Phil managed to give himself this impression of being a big beast. Phil Hogan's political instincts, in my opinion, were dreadfully bad. Really, genuinely, horribly bad. And for whatever reason, people didn't just seem to notice. He had established a reputation for rising early so he could stay in bed all day. But I think his political instincts were really not good. So if I were Simon, I would not be seeking him out. That's not to say you wouldn't have a chat the way you do with older, wiser men. You think because people are old, they must be wise. He could be talking to him. He could be talking to Ivan Yates, although probably not, as we know.
I think there's actually, we're talking about how Leo and Harris are quite similar in many regards, and they are, but in a way that they're absolutely different. I think looking at how Leo treated Hogan is actually a good example. I don't think Harris would have shanked Hogan like that, and if he had shanked
not
him, he
like
would have
that.
Shanked him.
Yeah.
No, I mean, he might have shanked him, but one, he would have made sure it didn't immediately come from him, and two, that if he shanked him hard enough to keep him down. Which is a wonderful reminder that, you shouldn't punch people, but if you do have to punch someone, you want to punch them hard enough that they're never coming off the mat. Like, Hogan has borne a grudge. And I mean, that's nothing new for Hogan, has held, he has agitated against, he's just been generally pissed off at Leo for years now. I think you're probably right. I think this is Hogan trying to insert himself into an advisory role with Harris, and Harris probably humouring him. Because, Hogan's political instincts, I think, would be suspect. Not to say he can't come up with a good idea.
No. And you know what? Holding a grudge, not the right to hold the grudge, but Varadkar was wrong, and the way they handled the Hogan thing was wrong. They ultimately sabotaged him in such a way that he had to leave the commission, which meant we lost trade, we lost a really important, really influential position on the commission, and we traded it in for a nothing, and we got nothing out of it, and it was a nothing story. It was very, 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 very silly. The lesson is, it's like Bertie. Bertie absolutely believed, never make an enemy where you don't absolutely have to. But like it says in The Wire, if you're going to come for the king, you don't miss. So if you're going to take them out, take them out all the way. Now, sometimes it's hard to do that. But no, Phil never got him. Phil is very thin-skinned. Anybody who knows Phil will tell you that. That even though he is big Phil and he's all what people think he is, he's actually quite thin. And that really has, we are told, rankled and grumbled with him. And understandably, I suppose.
It will be interesting to see how this shapes out. Harris, I think, could do nearly anything. And as I said, he could be quite good if he comes to believe that actually delivering something is what will keep him in power. I think there's a lot to be said for coming in, moving quickly on a couple of big issues that do have kind of a quite quick solutions to them, like the immigration issue. A lot of that could be solved quite quickly.
I don't think he even has to solve anything, because I don't think actually in the space of time he has, he can really solve much, but he can make actions. He can make decisive statement actions that make it look like he's going to solve something. And I think for the time being, that would be enough.
I think so. I think were he to come in, make the right noises, make the right sounds, put in place one or two of the right policies, take the government out at the knees for the local and nationals or local and Europeans, run it all then and see how he comes out. Now that's a high risk, high reward strategy, Michael. But I wonder if Simon is looking at how long he has, whether or not that will seem more attractive to him than potentially waiting for the perfect time and it just slipping him by. and Sinn Féin moving into an upswing or other things coming in.
Sorry, in that context, let's look at the poll, because that will, I think, give us a clue onto where he might be thinking. So we have Sinn Féin on 25% here.
What's they get in the last general?
If my memory serves, and some, it often doesn't, did they get, oh God, I was going to say 25.5, but no, it was higher than that, wasn't it? Or was it? 25.5 is the number in my mind, but maybe that was that Fine Gael? Google it there, Gary.
I think they got just under 25% of the popular vote in its entirety.
Now, you could say, well, that was a great result. So why wouldn't this be a great result if they repeated it? Well, as we know, Gary, that's not the way the game works. But the big problem is not so much that they're 25 now, but rather that they are on this trend, and the trend is not great.
No.
And also, the trend in the context of what has happened recently politically, which is the amendments and the immigration stuff. And this is something we've been talking about quite a bit, that first of all, that whatever about anything else, the weird thing was that because the choice they made about the rerun, etc., that the party which was potentially most damaged by the referendum was in fact Sinn Féin. And I think this is indicative that this may be true. Also, and this is something, as regular listeners will know, Gary has been talking about for a long time, is the gap between the top of Sinn Féin and the Sinn Féin voter is bigger than any other political party. And that is a problem that they have to manage. And it's not to say that they can't manage it, because they have been historically very good at this kind of thing. But it is a very big challenge. And Gary, are we looking at that challenge becoming more challenging?
I think the thing to always remember at Sinn Féin is that they're smart, they're well organised, and they're exceptionally well funded. In a way, the other parties just aren't. I do think you're starting to look at, on the referendum, I think the fact Leo resigned so quickly afterwards is going to help them if they want to play into the, you know, well, it was just a shambles and we sort of went along with it and, you know, kill Leo and try and displace some of the blame. I think that is helpful to them. I think what the referendum showed is that they have, to a certain degree, lost the ability to read their voters in a way that they hadn't up to this point. And I think you see it most clearly in Mary Lou McDonald's statement that, we'll rerun the referendum if it loses.
Yeah, self-inflicted wound.
Well, I think there, what you see, that is the sort of thing you say when you think, okay, well, maybe a large amount of our more progressive voters aren't going to be sure and need, you know, an excuse to say no. Basically, you're trying to pull a Fine Gael move there and do something a little bit smart. But the fact that they would do it and then, like, strong Sinn Féin areas would come back with, you know, 80, 90% no votes.
Yes.
Makes me think that they are misjudging the prevalence of those more progressive voices in their voters. And probably by quite a substantial amount.
Yeah.
And that's not a mistake I would have traditionally associated with Sinn Féin over the last 10 years. So I think that is going to be a little concerning for them. As we go into this, the locals will be quite interesting as well. What the local councillors in Sinn Féin are saying and what the National Party is saying is just, it's always been quite different, but it's very different now.
Yes.
And I wonder if people will realise that. And I think we talked before, Michael, about the referendum. We're saying the referendum itself doesn't really matter. But Sinn Féin want to be very careful that people don't, who would vote for Sinn Féin, don't listen to what the National Party is saying and then turn around to their councillors and say, but that's not what you're saying. Because once they start pulling at that thread, as we know, the variance between the party's position and the position of its voters is massively different, partially because I think Sinn Féin councillors, you could say they're misleading people, Michael. I think that they're actually putting forward their own views and those views just aren't represented in the national programme.
But that represents its own risk, because one of the things that could happen is, on one hand, the voter may become disenchanted with the party and stop voting, or The local councillor, in the face of these questions, may decide that his best bet is to detach himself from the party and keep the votes but lose the party. And I think that there's a risk that we've seen that a little bit over the last couple of years with councillors leaving Sinn Féin. And that may become a bigger problem for them, where more outspoken, more independently minded, in some ways more traditionally Republican but socially more conservative, traditional, nationalist, populist kind of councillors, are going to become detached from the party and just say, okay, listen, I'm going to be independent Sinn Féin or independent or whatever that is. But the pressure is going to come one side or the other side. And to speak to your point, they just don't want people noticing. Because once people start to notice, it creates problems.
On your point on the councillors, I mean, every party has unhappy councillors. It's just, it's a fact of political life and they have to be managed. Over the last few years, Sinn Féin councillors have been getting, the ones I've talked to anyway, a lot of them have been getting more and more unhappy with the central party. I think Sinn Féin always had an advantage that its people feel an immense loyalty to the party. In the same way, I think, you know, Fianna Fáil would have generated that kind of loyalty. You go back, well, probably at this point, about 40 years. Maybe 30. If you're a councillor and you try and break away, you probably weren't going to take a lot of the local... You weren't going to pull a Healy Ray and take the entire apparatus with you when you left. But if they are pissing off, you know, their actual ground supporters and activists as well, because they've noted that what they've been told is going to happen is not what Sinn Féin is actually saying is going to happen nationally, and it becomes possible to start for councillors to leave and take chunks of the administration with them, it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I don't think they're at that point yet, but they're clearly going towards it. And a lot of their choices in relation to the local elections and a lot of the movements from Sinn Féin headquarters, whether it's in gender quotas, whether it's in whatever, some of their selections for who should be running, seem to have just pissed off people who have decent sways over the local party. And again, just fights that I think Sinn Féin has historically not been overly concerned with making enemies of its own people because there was such loyalty and such cohesiveness.
Yeah.
But they are acting as that cohesiveness is still as it was 10 years ago while taking actions that undermine it. And I'm not sure they quite realise the danger of what they're doing.
I think also in the last 10 years, it's just a fact that they have evolved policy-wise in one direction continuously. So it's not just that time has changed, but time has passed, but also the party has become more progressive. The national question has become less and less the absolute single dominant issue. So weirdly, ironically, for a party which is essentially a nationalist populist party of the left, they're increasingly, in a sense, uncomfortable with that kind of nationalist identity. But that's something that is very important to their voter.
Where you said the populist party of the left, I think historically they were just a populist party in pretty much exactly the same way Fianna Fáil were. And a lot of the people they represented views on certain issues were left-wing. But that was kind of incidental.
Yes.
Whereas now, as they're professionalizing, as NGOs start reaching out to them, as effectively there appears to be an attempt to reshape the top of Sinn Féin to put in more professional types, academics, a lot of the people in Sinn Féin who are, shall we say, more of the old school seem to be being sidelined or outright removed. I think they've become a party of the left, and that is kind of a problem for them. Because you can be left-wing for utilitarian reasons and be very, very popular. But if you actually start to take an ideological position, you lose some of your, shall we say, flexibility, Michael.
The word there, the key word, I think, is ideological. Fianna Fáil would have been founded and would have always self-identified as a party of the left. It was a party of the small farmer, the party of the men of no property. It was a party of social welfare, of the safety net, the old age pension and all that kind of stuff. But it was absolutely not ideological. There was no element of this which was based on a close reading of Das Kapital or the Communist Manifesto, or let alone Gramsci. This was, if it came out of anything, it came out of kind of maybe an Arthur Griffiths Sinn Féin sort of autarky and Christian, a sort of a Christian sense of duty, a Catholic social teaching, you know, that protect the rights of workers, Leo the 13th and all that. But it was absolutely not ideological, but it was left-wing. I think Sinn Féin would have been, at least elements of Sinn Féin would have been like that. Then there were elements in Sinn Féin which were ideological, which were Marxist. And I think that that ideological element has become more dominant and more important. And the fact that they were both, for a while, reaching the same conclusions for various different reasons meant that that in Marxist terms, that internal contradiction was not being manifest. But I think some of those internal contradictions are now being manifest, and that potentially is going to lead to a crisis. But we shall see. I think some of the numbers here are interesting, like Sinn Féin down to 25. Fianna Fáil is 16%. It's 5 polls ago, they were 22. They are now 16, 17, 16, 16. They seem to be nailed in around that number. You have Fine Gael down to 19%, which I think is the lowest for this poll for forever, I think. I don't think they've ever been at 19% before. Since in Leo's time, anyway. Independence up to 17.
Actually, to say one good thing about Leo and the way he left, you have a situation where things are not going well. Maybe there's numbers against you. But rather than actually trying to fight it off, you just go, okay, I'm going to fall on my own sword, rather than actually try and fight it. And I would contrast that with Micheál Martin, a man who has seen the, shall we say, managed decline of Fianna Fáil. It strikes me as akin to what happened with the church, of just decay is inevitable, but let us manage to the decay, rather than attempt to actually revitalise the party. But he sticks around, and he just keeps going. Whereas at least Leo went. And I think, actually, there's a lot laudable in, at some point, just accepting you have to go. And it's in everyone's best interest, rather than actually going, no, we're going to wait for the heave, and we're going to act against it, and we're going to try and keep ourselves here as long as possible, for reasons that don't seem terribly clear.
Maybe. I okay, go if you have to go. I personally think that the timing of this, two, whatever, and a bit months ahead of the Europeans and the locals, is actually pretty pissy for Fine Gael as a party. I don't think that Leo has ever seemed to me to be a man who had any particular interest in party or party building. He never seemed to me to have any deep sentimental attachment to the party. He had no friends in the party. Well, he had no friends in the party because the friends that he had, he shat on from a height. And one or two of them still say they're friends. Others, I don't think, would piss on them if he was on fire.
His ability to turn TDs, who were allies of his, into not just people who were apathetic towards him, but who are actively rooting for harm to him.
I mean,
harm. Is incredible.
Actual harm. But you're talking about Micheál Martin. I'll tell you where Micheál Martin has been successful. He has managed to establish, and I don't know how he did it, this narrative in the media, and maybe I've said this before, I don't know, that one of the things you have to give Micheál Martin at least is that he came into Fianna Fáil when Fianna Fáil was in crisis, and he stabilised it. He got the ship steady because Fianna Fáil was in a terrible state. Gary, Fianna Fáil are on 16% in this opinion poll. In 2011, when only the most blind, saved, born-again Fianna Fáiler would vote for Fianna Fáil, they got 17.4% of the vote. I think that under any reasonable metric, if you were going to say, is this leader a success or a failure simply on the basis of the numbers of votes that they're getting and how they're polling, it's a bloody disaster. On the day of the 2011, when people, a lot of people felt it would be actually immoral because of what had happened to the country to vote for Fianna Fáil, there had to have been, well, we had, and we have an idea from some of the polling, that there were 7-8% of Fianna Fáilers who didn't vote for someone else, but just stayed at home, couldn't vote for Fianna Fáil, but couldn't vote for anyone else. And halfway decent vote outreach, shall we say, from the leader, would the least they could have done was to bring those people back, so that you go from 17, you go back up to 24-25%. And as your toxicity wore away, and as you... But do you know what he did, Gary? Instead of trying to get the traditional Fianna Fáil voter back into the party, to reattach them, to reignite their loyalty, to bring those warm, fuzzy memories of the great days of Albert and Charlie, he alienated them. He did nothing which was Fianna Fáil. He did nothing which spoke to their needs or to their values. In fact, he told them he didn't like them. And if you tell people you don't like, is it any wonder the Healy Rays get the vote that they go, or Matty McGrath gets the vote that he does, etc., etc.? When the leader of the party was telling you, we don't want you.
I think it is worth pointing out, because, I mean, they've been in this position for over a decade now. You know, what Fianna Fáil used to be. Martin has overseen, I believe, three of the worst election results Fianna Fáil has ever had in its history. Even at the height of Micheál Martin, which was 2016, they get, you know, what, 44 seats? In 1927, they won 44 seats. And that's how far you have to go back to find 44 is the height of Micheál Martin's election results.
Yeah.
And up to his period, it's a match with the worst result Fianna Fáil had ever received. And he's kept it up for three elections. They get about 22-24% of the popular vote. You go back to Ahern, you're looking at 41-42%. You go back to Haughey, you're in like 45. Lynch, you're in like 50.
Plowing over ancient lands, my point is simply, the notion that he didn't stabilise it. What he did, he stabilised it in much the same sense that a mosquito in amber has been stabilised. It may be stable, Gary, but it's dead. And right now, that's what Fianna Fáil is. If you look at the demographics of Fianna Fáil, they have the worst demographics of any party in the country. Unless they get new people in, Fianna Fáil will simply disappear through natural wastage.
Yeah, but they made kind of the traditional kind of business strategic decision that screws you, where you look at your existing voters and go, we need new voters, or we need new consumers, and you massively change your product in order to appeal to new consumers without actually asking, one, do new consumers want this, and do they want it from you?
Yeah.
And two, what will your existing consumers think of this new product?
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, I think what you've seen under Martin is this strange cannibalization of itself, where it's pulling in new people, but not as quickly as it's losing its old voters, who are mostly deserting it for Sinn Féin. And that drives Sinn Féin massively up, which is what it is.
Sinn Féin and the independents.
And the independents. I mean, independents at 17% is ridiculous. And again, a point we've made before, in Ireland, people who vote independent tend to be more socially conservative, sometimes fiscally conservative, but mostly socially conservative. That is the vote it is. It is a kind of populist, traditional Fianna Fáil vote of people who tend to have a sense of nationalism and family and the home and those sort of things, but are not deeply ideological. And there's 17% of the electorate that Fianna Fáil probably should have.
Fianna Fáil should have at least 10% of that. I absolutely believe that of that 17%, you could take 10 out without changing anything except the tone and the music of the leadership in Fianna Fáil. And you could change Fianna Fáil from 16% to 26%, which would make them the biggest party in the country. And that would still leave, and that's without getting any of your Sinn Féin voters back, and still leaving the independents with 7%. So, and it's leaving AIM 2, and I think AIM 2 has attracted. I mean, AIM 2 is on 5% now. That's not nothing. 5%, and I'd say some of those votes are Fianna Fáil votes as well, historically. I mean, these votes don't belong to anybody. They go where they go.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they can keep that up in the next polls. Because we're coming into the locals and the Europeans, there's going to be a lot more political polling than there would normally be. So actually, we'll be able to see if there's a trend there in AIM 2 fairly quickly. But if it is, I mean, it's great for them.
Just before we go, there was a funny story. I thought an interesting story in the context of what we're talking about here. The changing face. And somebody thinking in a kind of a macro level at a local level. I don't know, Gary, did you see that Verona Murphy she launched her campaign for the local elections in Wexford?
She did. 10 candidates, was it? 10 good candidates, from what I've
seen. Ten good candidates, and taken from all over the. I mean, you got people with the historic connections to Sinn Féin, people with connections with Fine Gael, people with connections to Fianna Fáil, people coming from business backgrounds, people coming from the volunteer and the charity sector, all over the place. Ivan Yates and Micheál MacDool down to help her launch.
That it's interesting because I'd heard about Yates, but I hadn't heard about MacDool.
Yeah, so two big beasts, Gary. Two big beasts. Her own backroom team, some of the savviest people around the gaff in Wexford politics. Again, well connected with historic Civil War parties, if you like to call them that. And I wonder if this maybe is the way to go. I think Noel Grealish does something like this. He has his own local councillors as well. But this is going to be potentially a proper challenge to Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and indeed Sinn Féin in the local elections in Wexford. There is a decent, I don't know. What realistic the chances are of all 10. But I talked to somebody who said to me, because I said to them, you know, any one of these could get elected, to which he said, on the basis of current sentiment and the level of pissed offness and anti-government voting there is, not that anyone could get elected. I think all of them will be elected. Now, that seems to me to be a big notion, big statement. But if Verona Murphy got 10 councillors elected, well, for a start, it's a tremendous boost to her and her chance of keeping her seat, although I think I'd have a fiver on Verona topping the poll anyway. 10 county councillors, that turns you into a real thing, Gary. And if that's going to be the strategy that more and more of independents across the country are going to pursue, I think that's a real problem for the legacy parties, because if you get yourself bedded into the county council and you're in the Dáil. One of the problems independents have is that they spend too much time trying to protect their base and they're stretched. But if you can create a party for yourself in micro at a county level, it takes a lot of that worry and stress away. You get a lot of the clinic work done at the local level, and that creates a long-term problem for the legacy parties to try and get that seat back, if they can.
It does. I mean, councillors are incredibly, incredibly helpful in getting TDs elected. I think actually that might be another reason to go in, to basically for Harris to do this early, because you're seeing this in a lot of the independent spaces. The independent politicians, the independent parties are putting a lot of focus on basically building these networks of councillors, which you've seen, I mean, the Hedy Reyes have done it very well, Lowry has done it very well, and the other, I think, independent politicians have started to pay more attention to this than they did historically. Now, they, you know, in the past, they might have had one or two councillors, but this idea that actually you can just, you can do this en masse.
Yeah.
But as I was saying, these people lack money and organisational capability. So if they are deeply invested in doing this and you pull a general on them on the same day,
yes, yeah.
Much chaos. More difficult to handle.
Much harder.
Yeah. Which I think is you know, it could work out quite well. There was one thing I wanted to mention in relation to immigration, Michael.
Yeah.
On the Red Sea poll, they asked people, would they support the plan by the EPP, the European People's Party, which is a plan. The EPP is kind of centre-right in the European Parliament. It's coming under pressure from the right all over the place. And so it's moving on immigration.
Yes.
And so it came out with the idea that, you know, perhaps we should process asylum seekers in third-party countries.
Yes.
So basically the English-Rwandan policy.
Yeah. Or Jason O'Mahony's policy.
Yeah, which I would note is actually a decent policy. Legally, it's, you know, there's a lot of trouble getting it over the line, but it's popular with voters and actually makes a lot of sense. I do remember when Fine Gael politicians started kicking the crap out of the Rwandan policy, I think we made the point that they might want to be careful about that one, because the EPP it already at that point started talking about how it might do this. Yeah. And they did not listen, and now they're having their own statements thrown back at them, and they're having to explain, well, no, it's not quite like that, even though looking at it, yeah, a lot of the specifics do seem to be the same. But the poll was quite interesting, because 60% of the voters said that they thought asylum seekers should be processed in a third-party country before access to Ireland. But here's the other interesting thing, Michael. 24% of people said they don't know, which means opposition is only at 16%.
Yes. Yeah, very low. And that's interesting, particularly in the context of the High Court judgment regarding the United Kingdom.
Oh, yes, that they can't be judged as as a safe country of origin.
It can't be returned to as a safe third country. Maybe I didn't. At least in part, this was because of the Rwanda policy, that you couldn't be guaranteed that they wouldn't end up being sent to Rwanda and therefore the court. So it'll be interesting to see how the European law does develop on that. If the EPP gets in power along with, say, the ECR and the Liberals, we may see a distinct change in the direction there.
Yeah, and people might get to see always that fun moment where parties and people who are saying we can't do that because there are legal issues actually decide they want to do something, and then it becomes, oh yeah, there might be some court cases, but, you know, they have to win them. And then even if they win them, we can just change the law.
But yeah, I mean, that's the thing that always gets me of people in legislatures saying, oh, it's a legal issue. Well, then change the bloody law if it's a legal issue. Really? I mean, God, that is literally your job.
Yeah, that might be trouble in the courts. I mean, if only we knew someone who had the ability to amend law.
You know, politicians come out, somebody should do something about this. Well, yeah.
And then you get this sort of wonderful, but then the NGOs would bring cases and they, you know, they have a lot of resources. And you're like, stop giving them resources.
Stop giving
them money. If you want to do something and you're worried that certain people may try and slow it down in the courts, but they can only do so because you're giving them large amounts of money, stop giving them money.
If you're worried about them throwing Molotov cocktails, stop buying them petrol.
And here's an interesting little point, Michael. If it were made known to some of the NGOs that if they took certain cases that you would take away their money, I think a lot of those cases wouldn't be taken.
Gary, and we'll finish up on this because we're rattling on. Many moons ago, Brian Lenihan Jr. heroically took on the job. We say heroically because he, I think, at that time knew that he had pancreatic cancer. Took on the job of Minister for Finance. But before that, I believe he was Minister for Justice. And he was being interviewed. Some friends of mine used to refer to him as the dark Lenihan. And it wasn't just his physical appearance, but there's something brooding about him. Anyway, there was something of a brouhaha happening because of activity on an island, a traffic island near the airport. And there had been comments from certain publicly funded NGOs. Well, they're all public, well, mostly publicly funded NGOs. And somebody put this to him, and they've said this and, you know, blah, it's all very upsetting and human rights and whatever. And he looked straight in the camera, in my memory anyway, he looked straight in the camera and said, "I find it very upsetting that," and he paused, "a state-funded body would encourage people to break the law." And he stopped and then moved on. And do you know what, Gary? I asked people if I had missed it, but to my knowledge, from that moment on, that state-funded body stopped commenting completely on that particular subject. So I think there is, if you can supply an incentive, even in a, and shall we say, an implied incentive to these groups, then they too, Gary, can go on a journey. They too can evolve.
And that's the sort of thing, Michael, that a stronger Taoiseach, less concerned with tradition, might do. I mean, if, let's say the NWCI, which, as we know, is an organization, which, what was it, 96% of their staffing costs over the last 3 years were paid for by the state, decided to hold a political event and not invite government TDs, rather than whining about it and saying how sad you were about it, perhaps a stronger person might have pointed out that they exist entirely because you allow them to exist. And it might be good for them to remember that.
Yeah, they might consider the relationship less like a modern democratic government, more like the relationship that Henry VIII had with some of his wives. Anyway, we should draw it to a close. Next week,
we won't be, both of us.
We will be away for Easter. We shall be away working on behalf of the people. So unless we do this whilst we're away, but the chances are we won't. So have a happy Easter.
All the best.